and flame. For a second, Lyra could see their faces, lurid, enraptured, pressing themselves together in a final embrace. Then they were gone, and something was happening among the machinery above the tank. Jets of superheated steam were forcing their way into the cylinders and slamming the pistons to and fro, making the connecting rods swing backwards and forwards as they turned a gigantic wheel, everything moving with the smooth ticking of lubricated machinery. Lyra and Kubicek could only stand back in shock. Then she turned to the sorcerer, who was shutting his book with the air of having completed a long and arduous task.
"What have you done?"
she found herself saying.
"Started my engine," he said.
"But how? Where are they, the man and his demon?"
"They are both fulfilling the destiny they were created for."
"They weren't created for this."
"You know nothing about it. I arranged for their birth. I brought the demon here for this work, but her boy escaped. No matter. I arranged for you to find him and bring him here. Now your part is over, and you can leave."
"Their father betrayed them, and you did this to them?"
"I am their father."
Lyra was dazed. The machinery was working faster now. She could feel the whole cellar trembling with the force of it. The crocodile had fallen still, apart from the slow swing of its tail. The homunculi in their bottle had stopped screaming and banging on the glass and were floating contentedly in the fluid that contained them, which was now glowing a faint and steady red. The metal bird in its cage, its golden feathers now gleaming with rich enamels and precious stones, was singing as sweetly as a nightingale. Agrippa stood calmly, book in hand, as if waiting for Lyra to ask a question.
"Why?" she said. "Why do it like this? Why sacrifice two lives? Couldn't you build a fire in the normal way?"
"This is not a normal fire."
"Tell me why,"
Lyra said again. "This is not a normal engine. Not a normal fire. Not normal steam."
That's all they were. Just a different kind of steam. Steam is steam.
"Nothing is only itself."
"That's not true.
Nothing is any more than what it is," Lyra said, quoting Gottfried Brander, feeling uneasy as she did.
"You've fallen for that lie, have you?"
"You think it's a lie?"
"One of the biggest lies ever told. I thought you would have more imagination than to believe it." That took her aback.
"What do you know about me?"
she said.
"As much as I need to."
"Will I ever find my demon?"
"Yes, but not in the way you think."
"What does that mean?"
"Everything is connected."
Lyra thought about that.
"What is my connection with this?" she said.
"It has brought you to the one man who can tell you whether to go east or south on the next stage of your journey."
And she felt dizzy. This was all impossible, and it was all happening.
"Well," she said, "which way should I go?"
"Look in your clavicula."
He gestured towards her notebook. She turned to the page with the added lines in pencil and found, under his name and address, something she'd missed before. The words, "Tell her to go south."
"Who wrote this?"
she said.
"The same man who wrote my name and address. Master Sebastian Makepeace."
Lyra had to grasp the side of the stone tank.
"But how did he..."
"You'll find that out in due course. There's no point in my telling you now. You would not understand."
She felt a light touch on her arm and looked around to see Kubicek, looking pale and nervous.
"In a minute," said Lyra, and to Agrippa she said, "Tell me about dust. You know what I mean by dust?"
"I have heard of dust. Of the Rusakov field, of course I have. You think I still live in the 17th century? I read all the scientific journals. Some of them are very funny. Let me tell you something else. You have an alethiometer, do you not?
Yes.
The alethiometer is not the only way to read dust. Not even the best way.
What other ways are there?
I will tell you one, that is all. A pack of cards.
You mean the tarot?
No, I do not. That is an egregious modern fraud, designed to extract money from gullible romantics. I mean a pack of cards with pictures on them. Simple pictures. You will know it when you see one.
What can you tell me about something called the Secret Commonwealth?
That is a name for the world I deal with. The world of hidden things and hidden relationships. It is the reason that nothing is only itself.
Two more questions. I want to find a place called the Blue Hotel, Al-Khan Al-Azraq, to look for my demon. Have you heard of that?
Yes. It has another name. It's sometimes called Madinat Al-Kamar, the City of the Moon.
And where is it?
Between Seleucia and Aleppo. You can reach it from either of those cities. But you will not find your demon without great pain and difficulty. And he will not be able to leave with you unless you make a great sacrifice. Are you ready for that?
Yes. And my second question. What does the word Akhtarake mean?
Where have you heard that expression?
In connection with a place called Karamakan. It's a way of travelling, or something like that, when you have to go Akhtarake.
It's Latin.
What? Really?
Aqua Terraque.
Water and land.
By water and by land.
Oh, so that means what?
There are some special places where you can only go if you and your demon travel separately. One must go by water, the other by land.
But this place is in the middle of a desert. There isn't any water.
Not so. The place you mean is between the desert and the wandering lake. The salt marshes and shallow streams of Lop Nor, where the watercourses shift and move about unpredictably.
Ah, I see, she said.
What Strauss wrote on those tattered pages she'd found in Hassel's rucksack had suddenly become clear. So much became clear. The men had had to separate from their demons to travel to the Red Building, and Strauss's demon had arrived successfully so he and she could enter. But Hassel's demon hadn't made it, though they must have found each other later. So that was how it worked. And she'd only be able to go there herself if Pan agreed to go through Lop Nor while she went through the desert. And then she'd be able to go into the Red Building. And as the clarification spread through her mind, blowing away all the mist and doubt, she remembered the feeling she'd had when she first read Strauss's journal. She was certain that she knew what was in the building. The knowledge flickered with promise like a mirage, but it still trembled just out of her reach. She stood in the smoky cellar, with the steady, confident beat of the pistons and the connecting rods and the valves above her, testifying to the unity at last of Cornelis and Dinessa, and tried to bring her attention back to Agrippa.
"How do you know about that?" she said. "Have you made the journey yourself?"
No more questions. Be on your way. Kubicek pulled at her sleeve, and she went with him to the staircase. She looked back at the cellar, where everything was alive, and where great, hidden purposes were at work. Agrippa was already reaching for a box of herbs, clearing a space on a workbench, taking down a set of scales. The steam engine had settled down into a quiet, powerful rhythm. And then Lyra saw the magician reach out a hand and take a small box that had seemingly floated to him by itself. Little lights glowed over a number of different jars, bottles, boxes around the shelves, and beside two drawers in a great mahogany cabinet. The sorcerer took something from every container lit in this way, and as he did so, the spirit, Lyra could find no other word, responsible for the light, flew across the cellar and joined its fellow on the bench. Everything in his cellar seemed alive and full of purpose, and Agrippa was perfectly busy, perfectly calm and in charge of what he was doing, completely fulfilled and eager for the next stage in his work. She followed Kubicek up the stairs and out into the empty waste ground. The men had gone, and the brazier was burning low. The cold air flooded into her grateful lungs and connected her with the night sky, as if it was a wind from the millions of stars. "Well, it's clear that I need the train for the south," she said. "Will I make it to the station on time?" A bell in the nearby cathedral struck two.
"If we go there at once," said Kubicek.
She went with him through the old city to the river and across the bridge. Lights glowed in some of the boats on the water. A cargo barge went past, moving on the current with a load of great pine logs towards the Elbe and Hamburg and the German Ocean. A tram trundled along the rails at the far end of the bridge, with three late travellers in its lighted interior. Neither of them spoke till they reached the station. Then Kubicek said,
"I'll help you buy your ticket, but first, let me see your clavicula."
He flicked through the little notebook.
"Ah," he said with satisfaction.
"What are you looking for?"
"To see if it had the name and address of someone in Smyrna. There is no one like us in Constantinople, but if you go on to Smyrna, you will find this lady helpful."
She put the little notebook away and shook his hand, forgetting till it was too late that her own had been painfully scorched.
"You had a strange evening in Prague," said Kubicek,
as they went towards the one lighted window in the booking office.
"But valuable. Thank you for your help."
5 minutes later, she was inside a sleeper cabin. Alone, exhausted, in some pain from her burned hand, but alive and exultant, with a destination and a clear purpose at last. And 5 minutes after that, the train began to move, and she was fast asleep. Chapter 21 Capture and Flight. Marcel Delamere was seldom angry. His disapproval took the form of a quiet, cold, precisely measured punishment, administered to those who had annoyed him. It was done so subtly that those who suffered it were at first flattered to think they had attracted his attention, until they realized its unpleasant consequences. But what Olivier Bonneville had done was more than annoying. It was direct and flagrant disobedience, and the punishment it deserved was exemplary. The Consistorial Court of Discipline was the body best able to deal with offences of that kind, and Delamere made sure they had every detail necessary to find Bonneville, arrest and interrogate him, including some facts about his background that Bonneville himself didn't know. The young man was not as cunning as he thought he was, and his trail wasn't hard to follow. The ticket he'd bought in Dresden would allow him to travel all the way downriver to Hamburg, so the CCD agents at various cities along the Elbe kept watch at all the stopping points. And as soon as Bonneville disembarked at the quay in Wittenberg, he was seen and followed by the single agent there, who promptly sent a message to Magdeburg, only a few hours downstream, asking for help. Their quarry himself wasn't aware that he was being followed. He was an amateur, and his tracker was a professional, after all, who watched Bonneville check into a shabby little guest house, and then sat in the café opposite waiting for his colleagues to arrive from Magdeburg. They had hired a fast engine boat. They wouldn't be long. Bonneville had spent much of the day with the alethiometer, hunched over his lap in the airless cabin, watching Pantalaimon's movements through the city, from his conversation with the girl at the school for the blind, to the rooftop journey, and his second conversation with a young girl, who was rather prettier than the first one. But the nausea was too much for Bonneville at that point, and he had to sit out on deck to clear his head of it. And by the time he'd recovered, Lyra's demon was talking to some old man about philosophy. It was so difficult. Looking made him sick. But hearing told him nothing about where the demon was. He had to look occasionally, or know nothing. His room at the guest house was no less stuffy than his cabin on the boat, the only difference being the smell of cabbage rather than the smell of oil. So, rather than bring on another bout of nausea, he decided to go for a walk in the evening streets and clear his head. If he kept his eyes open, he might see the creature anyway. The CCD man watched from the cafe as Bonneville sauntered out with his demon, some kind of hawk, on his shoulder. He was carrying a small bag, but he'd left his suitcase in the guest house, so presumably he'd be returning. The agent left a few coins on the table and followed. As for Pantalaimon, he was in the garden at St. Lucia's School for the Blind, curled up in the tree where he'd hidden that morning. He wasn't asleep. He was watching all the evening activity through the lighted windows, and hoping that the girl, Anna, would come out to visit her book again. But of course she wouldn't. It was cold and damp, and she'd be eating supper with her friends in the warm. Pan could hear their voices across the dark lawn. He thought about Gottfried Brander and Sabina. Perhaps they were still there, still quarrelling in that tall house with the barren attic. Pan reproached himself. He should have questioned Brander differently. He should have tried to speak to that mysterious demon, Cosima. He should have been more patient with the girl above all. She was so like Lyra, in some ways. And the thought brought an almost physical pang of longing. He supposed that Lyra was at the trout still, and he imagined her talking to Malcolm, and Asta, the beautiful gold-red cat, joining in. He imagined Lyra tentatively reaching out to touch her, knowing everything about what that gesture would mean. But no, impossible. He banished that thought at once. But he couldn't go back to her without what he'd come to seek. He was restless. For the first time, he wondered what he'd meant when he spoke of Lyra's imagination. He didn't know, but he knew he wouldn't go back without it. It was no good. He'd never go to sleep. He was too irritated with himself. He stood up and stretched, and leaped onto the wall and left the garden for the darkness of the streets. Bonneville strolled towards the Stadtkirche, looking into every doorway, every alley, and up to every roof. In order not to attract attention, he tried to seem like a tourist, or a student of architecture. He wondered whether it would help to have a sketchpad and pencil, but mist was gathering, and no one would be out sketching in conditions like this. In the bag he carried, as well as the alethiometer, was a coal silk net, extremely strong and light, in which he intended to catch the girl's demon, before taking him to somewhere private and interrogating him. He could see that happening in his mind's eye, because he'd practiced it many times, and he was so quick with the net, so skillful, that he thought it was a great pity that no one would see him in action with it. He stopped at a cafe in the main square, and drank a glass of beer, looking all around, listening to the conversations nearby, talking quietly with his demon. "That old man," he said, "the old man in the attic. We've heard those kinds of arguments before, the things he said. He's probably famous. I'm just trying to place him. You think the demon will still be with him?" "No. They weren't being friendly. Demon was accusing him of something. Something to do with her." "Yes. You think he'll go back there?" "Maybe. If we knew where the house was, perhaps. We could talk to him." "I don't know, though," he said. "If the demon's gone, the old man won't necessarily know where. They weren't on those kind of terms." "The other girl might know something," said his demon. "She might be his daughter." Bonneville found that suggestion more appealing, He was good with girls, too. But he shook his head and said, "It's all too speculative. We need to focus on him. I'm going to try something." He reached into his bag. The hawk demon, who suffered from the nausea just as he did, said hurriedly, "No, no, not now. I won't look. Just listen." She shook her head and turned away. There were half a dozen customers in the cafe, mostly middle-aged men who seemed to be settled for the evening, talking and smoking or playing cards. None of them were interested in the young man at the corner table. He held the alethiometer on his lap, with both hands around it. His demon fluttered from the back of his chair to the table. He closed his eyes and thought about Pantalaimon. And at first, he could only summon up images of what he looked like. And the hawk demon murmured, "No, no." Bonneville breathed deeply and tried again. He kept his eyes open this time, looking at his half-empty glass, and listened for the scratch of claws on cobbles, the noise of traffic, busy city streets. But all he heard was the mournful blast of a foghorn. Then he realized that he was hearing it in real life, because he saw two of the men at the other tables turn their heads in the direction of the river and speak to each other, nodding. There was the sound again. But coming into Bonneville's mind from another place altogether was that scratch of claws, men's voices, the splash of water, a deep thud as something large and heavy bumped into something large and immobile, the creak of rope on damp wood. A steamer tying up at the quay? So Lyra's demon was on the move again. "That's it," Bonneville said, standing up and packing the alethiometer into his bag. "If we get there right now, we might see him go aboard, and then we'll have him." He paid the bill quickly, and they left. Pantalaimon was watching from the shadows at the side of the ticket office. According to the notice on the wall, this boat was going all the way upstream to Prague. That would do to be getting on with. The quay was well lit, though, and the numbers of people coming down the gangway or going up made it quite impossible for him to get on board that way, even in the fog that was blurring the edges of everything visible. But there was always the water. Without stopping to think, he raced out from beside the ticket office and made for the edge of the quay. But he hadn't got halfway across when something fell over him. A net. He was snatched to a halt and tumbled over and dragged along the flagstones, struggling, twisting, snapping, tearing, biting. But the net was too strong, and the young man holding it was merciless. Pan felt himself swung into the air, caught a glimpse of his captor's face, dark-eyed, vicious, of astonished passengers watching, unable to move, and then several other things happened at once. He heard the roar of a smaller engine boat thrown into reverse gear as it pulled up to the quay. Exclamations from the passengers watching. A violent curse from the young man swinging the net. And then the sound of running feet over the stones, and a deep man's voice saying, "Olivier Bonneville, you're under arrest!" The net fell to the ground, with Pan struggling harder than ever, and only getting more entangled. He didn't stop tearing at it to watch, but he was aware of the men running from the engine boat, of the young man, Bonneville, Bonneville, loudly protesting, of the word demon coming from different voices in tones of shock and fear, and then of the hideous touch of an unknown human hand around his neck. It lifted him up and held him close to a man's face, to a smell of beer and smoke leaf and cheap cologne, and to bloodshot eyes that bulged horribly. The net was still tangled around him. He tried to bite through it, but that hand around his neck was tightening like an iron band. Dimly, he heard the young man's voice saying angrily, "I have to say my employer, Marcel Delamere of La Maison Juste, will not be at all pleased by this. Take me somewhere quiet, and I shall explain." That was the last Pan heard before he fainted. Mignon promised to be as light and graceful as Malcolm's boyhood canoe, La Belle Sauvage, had been. But the sail that he found and tried to hoist was frail and rotting. That was clear even in the darkness. It came apart in his hands. "Oars it is, then," said Malcolm, who knew that a boat that sailed well might be a brute to row. But there was no choice, and in any case the sail was white, or had been, and would show up far too well on a dark night. In the light of a match, he saw that the boathouse gates were fastened with another padlock, and found it harder to shift than the one on the door had been. He finally wrenched it free, and there was the lake in front of them. "Ready, monsieur?" he said, holding the little boat steady against the landing stage as the other man got in.
"Ready, yes, if God wills."
Malcolm pushed off and let the boat drift away from the shore until there was room to set the oars and start rowing. The boathouse stood in a small bay under the shelter of a rocky headland, and he expected the water to be more or less calm just there, and choppy outside the bay. But to his surprise, once they were out on the open water, with the whole length of the great lake curving away in front of them, the surface was as flat as glass. The air felt heavy to move through, and clammy. Everything was uncannily still. Malcolm enjoyed the sensation of using his muscles again, after days of travelling, but it was almost like being indoors. When he spoke to Karimov, he found himself lowering his voice.
"You said that you had some dealings with Marcel Delamere," he said. "What was his business with you?" "He commissioned me to bring him some rose oil from the desert of Karamakan, but he has not yet paid me, and I feared he was holding back the money in order to keep me in Geneva, because he wants to do me harm. I would have left before now, but I am penniless." "Tell me about this oil."
Karimov told him everything he told Delamere, and then added,
"But there was something curious. When I told him of the destruction of the research station at Tashbulak, he seemed not to be surprised, though he pretended to be. Then he asked me questions about the men from the mountains who attacked the station, and I answered truthfully, but again, I felt that he knew what he expected to hear, so I held back one thing."
"What was the thing you didn't tell him?"
"The men from the mountains did not destroy the place entirely. They were forced to flee by... And this is where it becomes hard to believe, monsieur, because they were forced to flee by a monstrous bird."
"A Simurgh?"
"How do you know that?" "I was not going to say that name, but..."
"I read about it in a poem." "That was true. It was a great bird that guided Jahan and Roxana to the rose garden in the Tajik poem. But it wasn't the whole truth. Malcolm also remembered it from the diary of Dr. Strauss, which the murdered Hassel had brought back from Tashbulak. The camel herder Chen had told them that the mirages they saw in the desert were aspects of the Simurgh.
"You know Jahan and Roxana?"
said Karimov, clearly surprised. "I have read it, yes. Naturally, I took it to be a fable.
Are you saying that such a thing as the Simurgh exists?" "There are many forms of existence, monsieur. I would not say that it was this one or that one or any other, possibly one we know nothing about."
"I see. And you said nothing about this to Delamere?"
"That is correct. It is my belief, based on what I observed during my interview with him, that he knows a great deal about the men from the mountains, and he did not wish me to know that he did. Oh, it makes me afraid that he will have me arrested and imprisoned, or worse, and that is why he was keeping me trapped in this city. When I learned about your situation, monsieur, I felt it was my duty to tell you what I knew."
"Well, I'm very glad you did.
May I ask in turn what Monsieur Delamere wants with you?"
"He believes I am his enemy."
"And is he correct?"
"Yes. In the matter of Tashbulak and the rose oil especially. I think he wants to use it for some evil purpose. And if I can stop him, I will. But first, I need to know more about it. You found someone who was trading in it, for example. Is there much trade in this oil?"
"Not very much. It is extremely expensive. It was used somewhat in the old days when people believed in shamans who could enter the spirit world. But now, not so many believe that."
"Is it used for anything else? Do people take it for pleasure, for example?"
"And there is not much pleasure to be had, Monsieur Polstead. The pain is extreme, and the visual effects are more easily obtained with other drugs. I think there are some doctors who use it to relieve various chronic conditions, both physical and mental, but it is so expensive that only the very rich can afford it. It was only the learned investigators at Tashbulak who had any interest in it, and much of their work was secret." Have you ever visited the station at Tashbilak?
No, monsieur.
Malcolm rode on. The silence over the lake was profound, the air stifling, almost as if all the oxygen had been withdrawn. After some time, Karimov said,
"Where are we going?"
"You see that castle?" Malcolm said, pointing to a crag on the shore not far ahead of them. At the summit stood a building whose massive towers bulked against the skyline only dimly, because there was no light from moon or stars.
"I think so," said Karimov.
"That marks the border with France. Once we're past that, we should be safe, because Geneva has no jurisdiction there. But..."
Between the "b" and the "ta" of that word, the entire sky came alight, and then fell dark again. Then came another flash, even brighter, and this time Malcolm and Karimov saw the forked and many-branched lightning stab its way to the ground at the same moment as they felt the first drops of rain, heavy gouts that slammed hard into their faces. Only after both men had turned their collars up and pulled their hats on more tightly did the thunder arrive, with a deafening crack that seemed to split their heads open. It rolled around the lake, rebounding from the mountains, and making Malcolm's head ring with its force. Already a wind was rising. It stirred the water up into waves and then flung them into spray that lashed Malcolm's face even more fiercely than the rain. He'd done some lake sailing in the past, and he knew how suddenly storms could arrive, but this was exceptional. There was no point in trying to get past the castle on the headland. He hauled the boat to starboard and rowed as hard as he could for the nearest shore, seeing his way by flashes of lightning as the huge whips of incandescence lashed the ground and threw a garish light over the mountains. The thunder followed close behind it now, loud enough to shake the little boat, or so they felt. Asta had crawled inside Malcolm's greatcoat and was lying there warm and relaxed, with a perfect confidence that transmitted itself to him, which he knew was her intention, and he blessed her for it. The little mignon was bobbing this way and that in the chaos, and shipping water fast. Karimov was using his fur hat to scoop out as much as he could. Malcolm hurled all the strength of his arms and his back into the labor, digging the oars deep into the water, and straining every muscle to keep the boat from being tossed or blown further back onto the lake. When he looked over his shoulder, he could see little but darkness and deeper darkness, but the deeper darkness was looming high above them now. It was forest, growing right down to the shore. He could hear the wind in the pines now, even behind the deafening drumming of the rain and the monstrous, crashing explosions of thunder. "Not far!" Karimov shouted. "I'll go straight in. See if you can grab a branch." Malcolm felt a shock and a grinding sensation as the mignon's wooden hull met a rock. There was no avoiding it. He could hardly see anything, and there was no sandy beach for the boat to land on gently. Rocks and more rocks, and after one final lurch and scrape, she was immobile. Karimov was trying to stand up and find a branch to seize, but he kept losing his balance. Malcolm held on to the gunwale and stepped over the side, thigh deep, before his feet found anything solid. The rocks were tumbled and irregular, but at least they were large, and they wouldn't roll under his weight and break an ankle.
"Where are you?" Karimov called. "Nearly ashore. Keep still! I'll tie us up as soon as I can!"
He felt his way towards the bow, and then found the painter. When he'd untied it in the boathouse, he'd noticed how old and worn it was. But it had been good manila cord when it was made, and it might have a little strength still. Asta climbed up onto his shoulder and said, "Up and to your right!" He reached in that direction and found a low-hanging bough, which felt solid enough to trust. But it was too far for the painter.
"Karimov!" he called. "I'll hold the boat steady while you get out. We'll just have to feel our way to the bank, but we're wet enough already. Get everything you need and go carefully."
A lightning flash very close threw a sudden searchlight on them. The bank was only a yard or two beyond the bow, thick with bushes, and rising steeply out of the water. Karimov gingerly put his left leg overboard and felt around for something solid.
"I can't reach. I can't find any rock." "Hold on to the boat and put both legs down."
Another lightning flash. Malcolm thought, what's the drill for surviving a storm if you're in a forest? Avoid tall trees to begin with. But if you couldn't see anything... The lightning had set off another of his spangled ring episodes.
The little thing twisted and scintillated in front of the lashing darkness all around, just at the moment when his hand found a branch low enough for the rope to reach. "Here!" he shouted. "This way! Here's the bank!" Karimov was floundering towards him. Malcolm found his hand and gripped it tight, and pulled the older man along towards the bushes, and then out of the water. "Got everything you need?"
"I think so. What do we do?"
"Keep together, and climb up away from the water. If we're lucky, we'll find somewhere to shelter." Malcolm hauled his rucksack and suitcase out of the boat, and lugged them over the rocks and up into the undergrowth. It felt as if they were at the base of a steep slope, maybe even at the foot of a cliff. There might be an overhanging rock if they were lucky. They'd only been climbing for a minute when they found something even better.
"I think here's a... just over this big rock."
Malcolm shoved his suitcase ahead of him and reached down to pull Karimov up.
"What is it?" said the Tajik.
"A cave," said Malcolm. "A dry cave. What'd I tell you?" The officers took Olivier Bonneville to the nearest police station and requisitioned the interview room. Strictly speaking, the CCD had no formal relations with the police force in Wittenberg or anywhere else in Greater Germany, but a CCD badge worked like a magic key.
"How dare you treat me like this?"
Bonneville demanded, of course. The two agents took their time settling onto the chairs on the other side of the table. Their demons, Vixen and Owl, were watching his with unpleasant vigilance.
"And what have you done with that demon?" Bonneville went on. "I've been pursuing him on the express orders of La Maison Juste, all the way from England. You better not have lost him. If I find that..."
"State your full name," said the agent who'd first seen him. The other man was taking notes.
"Olivier de Lusignan Bonneville, what have you done with..."
"Where are you staying in Wittenberg?"
"None of your..."
The interrogator had long arms. One of them reached out before Bonneville could move and slapped his face hard. The hawk demon screamed. Bonneville hadn't been hit since his elementary school days, having learned very young that there were better ways than violence of making life miserable for his enemies, and he wasn't used to shock and pain. He sat back and gasped.
"Answer the question," said the agent.
Bonneville blinked hard. His eyes were watering. One side of his face was bright red and the other was dull white.
"What question?"
he managed to say.
"Where are you staying?"
"A guest house."
"Address?"
Bonneville had to think hard to remember.
Friedrichstrasse 17, he said. "But let me advise you..."
That long arm shot out again and seized him by the hair. Before Bonneville could resist, his head was slammed face down on the table. His demon screamed again and flew up, flapping wildly before tumbling down. The agent let go. Bonneville sat up, trembling, with blood streaming from a broken nose. One of the agents must have rung a bell, because the door opened and a policeman came in. The note-taking man stood up and spoke to him quietly. The policeman nodded and went out.
"You don't advise me," said the interrogator. "I hope that alethiometer's not been damaged."
"I'm not likely to damage it," said Bonneville thickly. "I weed it better than anyone else. I know everything about it. I treat it with the utmost care. If it's damaged, it wasn't damaged by me. It's the property of La Maison Juste, and I weed it on the specific instructions of the Secretary-General, Monsieur Marcel Delamere."
To his annoyance, he couldn't keep his voice steady or stop his hands from shaking. He dragged a handkerchief from his pocket and held it to his face. His nose hurt abominably, and his shirt front was drenched with blood.
"That's curious," said the interrogator. "Seeing as it was Monsieur Delamere himself who reported it missing and gave us your description."
"Prove it," said Bonneville.
His disordered mind was beginning to pull itself together, and in the mist of pain and shock, he could just make out the shape of a plan.
"I still don't think you've got this the right way round," the interrogator said, smiling. "I ask, and you answer. Any minute now, I'm going to hit you again, just to remind you.
You won't see where that one's coming from either.
Where's Matthew Polstead?
Bonneville was baffled.
What?
Who the hell is Matthew Polstead?
Don't tempt me. The man who killed your father.
Where is he?
Bonneville felt as if his mind was coming loose from his body. His demon, now on his shoulder again, gripped tightly with her claws, and he knew what she meant at once.
I didn't know him by that name. He said, you're right. I've been looking for him. What have you done with that demon I caught? He was going to lead me to that Polstead man.
The polecat, or wherever he is nicely tied up next door. I take it he's not Polstead's demon. Whose is he?
The girl who's got my father's alethiometer. He's hers. If the Geneva readers found out that much, then I have to say I'm surprised. He's not usually that quick.
Reader? What do you mean, reader?
Alethiometer reader. Look, I can't concentrate with this bleeding. I need to see a doctor. Get me fixed up first, and I'll talk to you then.
I'm trying to make conditions now. I wouldn't if I was you. What's that girl's demon got to do with Polstead? And how come the demon's running around without her? Creepy, that's what that is. Unnatural.
Come on, there are aspects of this that are confidential. What security clearance have you got?
You're asking me questions again. I did warn you about that. You know, you've got another clout coming any second now, I'd say.
That won't help, said Bonneville, who had managed to control the shaking of his voice by this time. I don't mind telling you what I'm doing, since we're on the same side, but, as I say, I need to know the level of your security clearance. If you tell me that, I might even be able to help you.
Help us with what? What do you think we're doing? We've been looking for you, boy. We got you now, and why the fuck should we help you?
There's a bigger picture. Do you know why you've been looking for me?
Yeah, 'cause the boss told us to. That's why, you bit of jelly.
Bonneville's eyes were beginning to close. The blow must have bruised his cheekbones or his eye sockets or something, he thought. But don't show pain. Don't be distracted. Stay calm. We're getting there.
He said steadily, there's a connection between my father, what my father was doing, and his death, and this man, Polstead, and the girl, Lyra Balacqua, right? Monsieur Delamere has given me the job of finding out more about it, because I can read the alethiometer, and because I've already discovered a good deal. To start with, the connection involves dust. Got it? You understand that? You know what that means? My father was a scientist, as they call them now, an experimental theologian. He was investigating dust, where it comes from, what it means, the threat it holds. He was killed, and all his notes were stolen, and so is his alethiometer. The girl, Balacqua, knows something about it, and so does that Polstead man. That's why I'm here. That's what I'm doing. That's why you'd be much better advised helping me than wasting our time with this sort of thing.
Then why did Monsieur Delamere tell the CCD that he wanted you arrested?
You sure that's what he said?
The interrogator blinked. For the first time, he looked a little unsure.
I know the orders we received, and they've never been wrong before. What's just been happening in Geneva?
Bonneville demanded.
What do you mean?
I mean, what's been going on? Why is the city full of priests and bishops and monks and so on? This Congress, that's what I mean. Obviously, since it's the most important development in the Magisterium for centuries, it's important to keep security tight.
So?
So, messages get enciphered. Instructions are relayed by different routes. Code words are used. Sometimes, information's deliberately scrambled. This Polstead, for example.
Did they give you a description of him?
For the first time, the interrogator looked at his colleague, the man who was taking notes.
Yes, said the note-taker. Big man, red hair.
Just what I mean, Bonneville said. The information's not meant for the public. I know what his real name is, and I know he doesn't look like that. The red hair and the size,
Those details tell me something else about him.
What?
I can't tell you, obviously, unless I know your security clearance. Maybe not then, depending on what it is.
Level 3, said the note-taker.
Both of you?
The interrogator nodded.
Well, I can't then, said Bonneville. Look, I tell you what, let me talk to that demon. You can sit in, you can hear what he tells me.
There was a knock, and the door opened. The policeman who'd been sent to investigate the guest house came in, carrying Bonneville's rucksack.
Is it in there? Said the interrogator.
No, said the policeman. I searched the room, but there was nothing else.
If you were looking for the alethiometer, said Bonneville, you only had to ask. I've got it with me, of course.
He took it out of his pocket and placed it in front of him on the table. The interrogator reached out for it, but Bonneville moved it back.
You can look, but don't touch, he said. There's a connection that builds up between the instrument and the reader. It's easily disturbed.
The interrogator peered closely at it, and so did the other man. Bonneville thought, a knife in his eye now. That would teach him a lesson.
How'd you read it, then?
It works by symbols. You have to know all the meanings of each of those pictures. Some of them have over 100, so it's not something you can just pick up and do at once. This one belongs to the Magisterium, and it's going back there as soon as I've finished the mission they sent me on. So, I'll tell you again. Let me talk to that demon before he thinks of a good story.
The interrogator looked at his colleague. They both stood up and moved to a corner of the room, where they spoke too quietly for Bonneville to hear. In the pause, the tension that was helping Bonneville stay calm and stop his hands trembling began to seep away. His demon felt it, and gripped his shoulder so fiercely that she drew blood. It was just what he needed. When the men turned back to him, he was calm and composed, despite the bloody mess in the middle of his face.
All right, then, said the interrogator, as the other man opened the door.
Bonneville put the alethiometer away and picked up his rucksack to follow them. They were speaking to the policeman, who turned and took a ring of keys from his pocket and looked through them for the right one.
We're going to watch, said the interrogator, and we're going to make a note of everything you ask and everything he says in reply.
Of course, said Bonneville.
The policeman opened the door and then stopped suddenly.
What's the matter? Said the interrogator.
Bonneville pushed him aside and went in past the policeman. It was a room just like the one next door with a table and 3 chairs. The coal silk net was lying on the table, bitten to shreds, and the window was open. Pantalaimon had escaped. Bonneville turned to the CCD men in a fury that wasn't in the least assumed. Blood flowing thickly over his mouth and chin, nearly blind with pain, he denounced them and the police for their boneheaded stupidity and criminal carelessness, and threatened them with the wrath of the entire Magisterium in this life and the certainty of hell in the next. It was a fine performance. He certainly thought so himself a few minutes later, as he sat in a comfortable chair under the hands of the police doctor, and shortly afterwards stalked away towards the railway station, with his possessions intact and his pride in full flower. The bandage covering his nose was the badge of an honourable wound, the loss of Pantalaimon irrelevant. He had a new target now, one so interesting and so unexpected that it was like a revelation, an epiphany. It rang in his head like the tolling of a bell. The man who had killed his father, this large man with red hair, this man called Matthew Polstead.
Chapter 22. The Assassination of the Patriarch. Lyra arrived in Constantinople tired and anxious, completely unable to put out of her mind what had happened in Prague, or to understand what it meant. Her feeling of certainty and purpose had been brief and evanescent. She felt as if she had been used by some hidden power, as if all the events on her journey, and for long before, had been arranged with meticulous care with only one purpose. And it was a purpose that had nothing to do with her, and one that she'd never understand, even if she knew what it was. Or was it the beginning of madness to think like that? The only thing she could find any satisfaction in was the matter of being inconspicuous. She had a mental checklist. Where am I looking? How am I moving? Am I showing any feeling? She went through everything that might draw attention to her and suppressed it. As a result, she could now walk along a crowded street and hardly be noticed. It gave her a rueful kind of amusement to recall how only a few months ago she'd sometimes attracted looks of admiration or desire and had played at ignoring them haughtily while enjoying the power they gave her. Now what she had to feel pleased with was being ignored. The much harder thing was being without Pantalaimon. She was aware of a few things concerning her demon. He was not in danger. He was traveling. He was intent on something. But that was all. And although she picked up the alethiometer several times, in the solitude of her hotel room or railway sleeping compartment, she soon put it away again. The sickness brought on by the new method was unbearable. She did try the classic method, brooding over the images, trying to recall a dozen or so meanings for each one, and composing a question. But the answers she got were enigmatic, or contradictory, or simply opaque. Occasionally she felt a spasm of passionate fear, or of pity, or of anger, and knew he was feeling those things too. But she had no idea why. All she could do was hope. And she kept trying to do that, in spite of the fear and the loneliness. She spent some time writing to Malcolm. She told him about everything she saw and heard. She related the events involving the Burning Dutchman and the Alchemist, and told him the advice Agrippa had given her about her journey, and posted the letters to Malcolm care of the Trout in Godstow. But whether he'd ever get them, and whether she'd ever receive an answer, she had no idea. She felt so alone. She felt as if her life had gone into a kind of hibernation, as if part of her was asleep and maybe dreaming the rest. She let herself be passive. She accepted whatever happened. When she found that the ferry to Smyrna had just left, and that she'd have to wait 2 days for another, she heard the news calmly, found a cheap hotel, and wandered about the ancient city of Constantinople modestly and unobtrusively, looking at oratories and museums and the great merchants' houses along the waterfront, sitting in one of the many parks under trees that were still bare. She bought an English-language newspaper and read every word of every article, lingering over coffee in a warm and smoky cafe near the vast oratory of the Holy Wisdom, which rose like a giant bubble of stone above the buildings around it. The newspaper told her of attacks on property in the countryside, of rose gardens set aflame or dug up, of workers and their families slaughtered when they tried to defend their workplaces. There had been a spate of such attacks as far south as Antalya and as far east as Yerevan. No one knew what had set off this frenzy of destruction. The attackers were known simply as the Men from the Mountains. And according to some reports, these men demanded that their victims spurn their religion and take up a new one. But no one had any details about that. Other reports said nothing about religion, and only mentioned the looting and the destruction, and the inexplicable hatred expressed by the attackers towards roses and their scent. Other news in the paper concerned the forthcoming celebrations in honor of the patriarch, St. Simeon Papadakis, on his election as president of the new High Council of the Magisterium. There was going to be a lengthy service in the Oratory of the Holy Wisdom, in the presence of over 100 senior clergy from all over the province, followed by a procession through the city. The celebrations would include the consecration of a new icon of the Virgin Mary, which had appeared miraculously at the tomb of a 4th-century martyr, accompanied by various signs attesting to its supernatural origin, such as blossom on a honeysuckle growing over the grave, various sweet odors, the sound of heavenly flutes, and so on. Sweet odors, thought Lyra. To the Men from the Mountains, such things were anathema. To the established hierarchy of the church, they were the mark of heavenly favor. If the religious world was going to split, it might well be over a small thing like the scent of a rose. Malcolm would know why it was all happening. She'd write to him about it in her next letter. Oh, but it was so lonely. She made herself read more about this new High Council. The celebrations in honor of the Patriarch were happening that very morning, her second day in Constantinople, and she decided to go along and watch. It would be something to do. As a matter of fact, while Lyra was thinking about him, Saint Simeon was stirring uneasily in his marble bath, and thinking about the mystery of the Incarnation. His demon, the sweet-voiced Philomela, nodded beside him on her golden perch. The currents that the saint's body set up in the scummy water were uncomfortably cold now, and he called out,
"Boy! Boy!"
He could never remember the name of any of the boys, but it didn't matter. All boys were very similar. However, the feet he heard coming in answer to his call were not a boy's feet, being heavy and slow. A shuffle, instead of a light, darting step.
"Who is that? Who is that?"
said the saint, and his demon answered,
"It is Calumjin."
The patriarch extended a quivering hand and peered up at the bulky form of the eunuch.
"Help me up, Calumjin," he said. "Where is the boy?"
"His master the devil came last night and took him away. How should I know where the boy is? There is no boy to be found."
In the dim lantern light, it was hard to see Calumjin, except as a gigantic shadow. But his delicate, creamy voice was unmistakable. The saint felt himself lifted and placed, dripping, on the wooden duckboard, and a moment later swathed roughly in clean, heavy cotton.
"Not so rough,"
he said.
"I'll fall over if you shake me like that. The boy would be gentle. Where has he gone?"
"No one knows, your blessedness," said the eunuch, toweling less vigorously. "There will be another very soon."
"Yes, no doubt. And the water, you know, it gets cold more quickly than it used to. I am sure there is something wrong. The oil. Do you think the oil could make it lose heat? A new kind of oil, perhaps. It doesn't smell the same. It has a harsher quality. If the chemical composition is slightly different, you see, that might allow the molecules of heat to pass through the film of oil more easily. I'm sure there is something like that going on. I must ask Saint Mehmet to look into it."
Behind him, Kalungian's goose demon dipped her head towards the bath and smelled the water. The eunuch said,
"The oil is not the same, because the merchant who used to supply it has been summoned to the court of the Three Windows."
"You don't say? Oh, the scoundrel! What has he done?"
"Fallen into debt, your blessedness. As a result, he could obtain no more credit from the suppliers, and furthermore, they too are in trouble, and likely to go out of business."
"But what about my rose oil?"
"This is an inferior product from Morocco. It is all we could get."
Saint Simeon made a small noise expressive of disappointment. Calumjian knelt heavily to towel the holy shanks, while the patriarch's frail hand rested on his shoulder.
"No boys, no oil. What is the world coming to, Calumjian? I hope the boy is safe, at any rate. I was fond of the little wretch. Do they just run away, do you think?"
"Who can tell, your blessedness? Perhaps he thought they were going to make a eunuch of him."
"I suppose he might have thought that. Poor little fellow. I hope he is safe. Now, Calumjian, you will make sure that the water is sold cheaply. It would be wrong to let people think they were getting the same quality as before. I am quite firm about this."
The saint's bathwater, being sanctified by contact with his person, was bottled and sold at the palace gates. Saint Simeon was about the only man in the palace who did not know that the officials took a homeopathic attitude to its quality and diluted it severalfold. But saints were not expected to be worldly about such matters. A previous patriarch, expressing surprise when he discovered the gallons and gallons on sale, had to be assured that the holiness of the water caused it to expand in size, and that a number of bottles routinely burst from sacramental exuberance.
"My drawers, Columgian, if you please," said the patriarch,
and still holding on to the soft bulk of the eunuch's shoulder, he stepped shakily into the silk garment before letting the eunuch fasten the ribbon around his little pot belly. In the process, Columgian took a close look at the suppurating ulcer on the saint's right shin, which must have been causing him abominable pain, but about which he said not a word. It will kill him in 6 months, Columgian thought, as he eased the old man's arms tenderly into the sleeves of his undervest and helped his damp and bony feet into the slippers. St. Simeon, for his part, was grateful after all that it was Columgian and not the boy who was dressing him, because the boy had no idea which way round to hold the cope, for example, and had once done up 35 of the buttons on the undervest before discovering that the last one lacked a hole to go into, and had to undo them all and start again. So the saint had to pay attention and direct the operation, which was trying. Columgian required no guidance, and the patriarch was able to withdraw his attention and attempt once again to think about the mystery of the incarnation, which was trying in a different way. So he stopped thinking about that and said,
"Columgian, tell me, these men from the mountains of whom we hear so much talk, do you know anything about them?"
"I have a distant cousin in Yerevan, your blessedness, whose family were put to the sword by a band of men who wanted them to abjure the Holy Church, and the doctrine of the Incarnation in particular."
"Oh, but that is appalling," the old man said. "And have they been found and punished, these heretics?"
"Alas, no."
"His whole family?"
"Almost all. Except for my cousin Sakisian, who was at the market when it happened, and for a young girl, a servant, who saved herself by promising to believe what the men told her to."
"The poor child."
The saint's dim eyes filled with tears for the little girl, who would now go to hell.
"Do you suppose, Columgian, that these men from the mountains have made away with the boy?"
"Perfectly possible, your blessedness. Take my hand now."
The saint obediently took the great soft hand he saw in front of him, and with Columgian's help, he braced himself against the weight of the little nightingale demon who struggled to his shoulder, though in truth she weighed barely more than a handful of petals. With Columgian's goose waddling ahead, they made their way out of the bath chamber and into the vestry, where the patriarch's outer robes were being prepared. The process was not so much a putting on as a climbing in, and indeed the outermost garment was constructed not unlike a teepee or yurt, with a frame of sticks and laths that allowed the saint to rest against it during the rigours of the long liturgy. There was even a vessel skilfully placed to collect the saint's urine, so that nothing need interrupt the service or trouble the patriarch, who, like many elderly men, felt his bladder behaving more and more capriciously. Columgian delivered the patriarch into the care of the three subdeacons. St. Simeon let go his hand with some reluctance and said,
"Thank you, dear Columgian. Please, see if you can find out more about, you know, the matters we discussed. I would be so grateful."
The eunuch saw what the patriarch didn't. The little brother Mercurius's bright, inquisitive, sympathetic glance flicker at once from under his charmingly tousled hair, flick to the patriarch's face, and then to the eunuch's, and then back to the patriarch. Columgian's heavy eyes rested on the subdeacon for a second longer than Brother Mercurius found comfortable, but the young man understood their message, and folded his hands as he turned his modest attention to the saint. The old man said the first prayer, and on went the cassock. Brother Mercurius was swift to kneel, his hands fluttering at the buttons, and stroking the heavy silk over the patriarch's legs as if to adjust the hang, but he watched for the helpless flinch as his hand brushed the right shin. Worse than last time. That was worth knowing. another prayer as the skullcap went on, another for the hood, another for the surplice, another for the stole, another for the girdle, one each for the sleeves, left and right, that covered the plain arms of the surplice. Each of these vestments was embroidered so thickly with gold and jewels that the patriarch was becoming more like a piece of ancient mosaic than a human being, and their combined weight was making the old man tremble.
"Soon, Holy One, soon," murmured Brother Mercurius, and knelt again to adjust the front of the lower garments as the great enfolding cope, with its substructure of tough struts and cross-pieces, was manoeuvred into place around the saint's shoulders.
"Brother," said the senior subdeacon warningly, and Brother Mercurius modestly ducked aside, managing to imply both a humble desire to serve and a rueful self-deprecation. How silly to forget that this was Brother Ignatius's job. His little Jaboa demon skipped out of the way, helpfully.
Brother, young brother, said the old man, please be good enough to trim the lamps in the